You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of September 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, Burkina Faso falls victim to a coup as presidential guards seize power and the country's leaders are arrested. What's next for the West African nation? Plus, what's to be gauged from last night's Republican debate? There was no shortage of pies hurled in Donald Trump's direction, but did any of the custard stick?
Mr. Trump said that he heard Mr. Bush very clearly and what Mr. Bush said. I think women all over this country heard very clearly what Mr. Trump said.
My studio guests Peter Fleming and Phil Clark will give us their take. We'll also look at the self-declared People's Republic of Donetsk and plans for a general election next month and take a wild guess as to how Ukraine might feel about that. And we'll turn to Australia for a rigorous analysis of the first 48 hours of the Malcolm Turnbull era. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And you are indeed welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark from the Department of Politics and International Studies at SOAS and Peter Fleming, Professor of Business and Society at Cass Business School, also author of The Mythology of Work. Welcome both. We will start tonight in Burkina Faso, where an old-school coup d'etat does appear to have occurred. Following yesterday's detention of Interim President Michel Kafando and Prime Minister Isaac Zida by the Presidential Guard, military officers have appeared on state television and radio announcing that they are now in charge of the country. Borders have been closed, a curfew declared, and gunfire has been heard in the capital, Ouagadougou. Phil, first of all, this is all fairly old school stuff, although not unheard of in Africa in recent years. We will get to that wider trend shortly. What is going on here? The military is still vaguely sympathetic to former President Blaise Compaoré, who was chased out of town by an angry mob a little under a year ago. Is the comeback on?
It does look like it. I think the big thing that happened after Compaoré was thrown out was that the presidential guard was kept intact. So that there was some overthrow in the rest of the military, but the rest of the military has always been quite weak. It's the presidential guard that has always held power. And this general who's taken control overnight, General Diendere, was always sort of Compaoré's right-hand man. It was always suspected that he kind of ran the show anyway. So he's the guy who's back in charge, and this is a real throwback to the Compaoré era in many ways.
Just to follow that up, Interim Speaker Sherif Sy has called for a popular uprising. There are some reports of protest. It is all somewhat opaque. Is he likely to get one? I mean, he's doubtless thinking of those enormous crowds of people that made President Compaoré entirely certain that he was no longer welcome. Are people likely to fancy taking on the military in the same way?
I think they might, actually. I mean, I guess the next day or two will tell us whether that's true or not. But this was a population that was extremely brave in October and November last year. No one thought that the protest last year would get to the stage where Compaoré could be thrown out. And it's a population that will not tolerate this new presidential guard-run regime. They'll see this as a reversion to the situation that they tried to overcome last year. So I don't think inherently that they will be cowed. It's going to be really interesting to see how much protest there is in the next day or two.
Peter Fleming, the expected bodies have all condemned the coup, the UN, the United States, the AU, ECOWAS, etc. I was thinking of the speech that President Barack Obama gave in Nairobi earlier this year, in which he made some fairly pointed observations about the reluctance of African leaders to leave office when their time was up. If Compaoré does fancy his chances, are we seeing a reversal of democracy in Africa? There has been the case of President Nkurunziza overstaying his welcome in Burundi, similar situations in the Democratic Republic of Congo and Rwanda.
Sure, definitely. It does seem to be a trend in post-colonial Africa at the moment, which has been a tragedy in some ways. However, I think that, and you know, Zimbabwe and Mugabe is a clear template of that. But there is a history running alongside this democracy deficit or attack on democracy that's really interesting. So in this case, we've got people like Thomas Sankara, who who is labelled the African Che Guevara. And we can see that kind of history poking its head into the domain now as well. So I think rather than portraying it in an ultra-negative light, which the African continent in terms of politics so often does, we need to keep in mind this kind of this sub-history that is very, very important to understanding the whole setup in countries like this.
Phil, I was composing before we came on air a partial list of real and attempted coups d'etat just this decade, because I think when you see those images of tanks parked on the president's lawn, men with gold braid and khaki on state television, it does all strike you as a throwback to the 1960s and 1970s, a pre-independence Africa. But Benin 2013, Burkina Faso also last year, the Central African Republic 2013, Egypt 2013, Guinea-Bissau 2012, Mali 2012, Madagascar 2009, Niger 2010, etc., etc., etc. Why does so much of West Africa in particular seem to have a problem getting away from this cycle?
I think partly it's that there's so much popular discontent with so many of the governments in West Africa. So there's a real protest atmosphere at the best of times. And what you usually need is a military that's willing to listen to the people and then seek some sort of overthrow. And I think those two factors have come together in West Africa, particularly in the last 7 or 8 years. But in that list that you've just given there, what's most interesting to me is that several of those cases have had multiple coups in the space of 2 or 3 years. So, and Burkina Faso is just the latest in that trend, a situation where effectively there was a popular overthrow in November of last year, the population rising up backed by the military. And people thought this might be the seed of democracy in Burkina Faso. And now we're here in the middle of 2015, basically seeing the military completely reverse that process from last year. So it's coup and counter coup. And that, I think, is also part of that West African trend.
Peter, a thought that has just occurred to me literally in the last few seconds, so this may turn out to be total nonsense as I unfurl it, but is there something in this impatience that we've seen, certainly in Burkina Faso, with that the people have for military dictators and for that sort of rule? Is it the same sort of thing that is driving migration from West Africa? There's an increased knowledge, in an age of the internet and smartphones that there wasn't 30 or 40 years ago, that it doesn't have to be like this, that other people in other places manage not to have to live like this, and why should we put up with it?
There has to be a big part in that. In this country in particular, with corruption, the involvement of various multinational corporations and other international entities. Life is hard, but it's a media savvy culture. So therefore, mobility and migration is going to be an important outcome of this. And I think it's also...
It's part of the same thing. People just don't want to wait.
Well, they've been waiting for a long time.
Well,
they've been waiting for a long time. And now the means of mobility are at their disposal, and also the West is becoming a little bit more receptive to their role. To their role, responsibilities, and their role in creating some of the situations that have been driving this migration.
Just on that point of Western involvement, one of the key features in Burkina Faso is that this presidential guard that's overthrown the government just overnight was trained by the US. And this is a trend that we've also seen in various West African states. Mali and their rebellion 18 months ago was exactly the same. It was effectively a US-trained set of generals that have overthrown often very popular governments. So the US, in Obama's speech, can come out and talk about democracy in Africa, but at the same time, they're also training some of the most virulent armies on the continent.
Well, moving seamlessly along on the subject of the United States and of somewhat restive electorates, let's take a look now at last night's Republican debate, which, as has been the way of these things, was quite entertaining so long as you were able to forget that one of these people might actually end up becoming president. The question hanging over this 11-way contest was whether any of the relatively grown-up contenders might pick this moment to take a proper pop at Donald Trump, the bloviating game show host thus far proving vexingly popular with the GOP's Yahoo wing. Peter, did we learn anything much last night? I mean, Rand Paul actually floated the idea openly of Trump with launch codes, which should have frightened more people than it seems to.
He comes across as this kind of Rodney Dangerfield character, but a nasty version. And he seems to, I don't know how he does it, but in all the photographs, he seems to insinuate himself right in the middle as if he is already the elect. I don't know. It's all very strange. I think there's a bit of a conspiracy here. I think, you know, before this campaign, Jeb Bush, Donald Trump got into a room and said, look, Donald, you just play the most outrageous character that you can, and it'll make me, Jeb Bush, look good. And not the nutcase I actually am. So you could actually really help me here. I don't know. I'm a conspiracy theorist there. But something doesn't feel quite right, because I suspect that Jeb Bush is going to come through and he's going to look like a moderate. He's going to look sensible. He's going to look like he's got a sensible, rational fiscal policy, none of which, of course, he does. But in comparison to Donald Trump, he does look like a more credible person.
See, I think most of that is correct, probably without the possibility that Bush and Trump actually arrange this in advance. I think Jeb Bush's big strategy is just to think, as long as I don't knock any scenery over, I'll be okay. Trump will burn himself out eventually, except Trump still hasn't. And the thing that must be worrying the other candidates slightly, Phil, is that Trump has done and said so many things which would not just end the campaign, but would end the career of any other politician. And he seems to be prospering not despite his oafishness, but actually because of it.
It's staggering. I mean, I looked at the US polls this morning, and again, there's been even a tiny spike in Trump's already very high approval ratings. I mean, what more does this man have to do? And I suspect all of the other candidates must have been taking the approach of that Australian ice skater, Stephen Bradbury, who thought, if I hang at the back of the pack for long enough, doing and saying basically nothing, all of these other complete lunatics will fall over and then I'll just come through and take the gold medal.
This is one of my favourite sporting moments of all time.
Just magnificent. Never gets old. And the tragedy for these other candidates is that does not seem to be happening in this race. I mean, the prediction of Trump's fall was supposed to come to fruition months and months ago. This guy seems to be growing in strength. So it's got to very dangerous territory now, I think.
I mean, we are still 5 months away from the first primaries. You forget what a grind an American presidential election is. Did any of the other candidates strike you as particularly impressive last night? I mean, it is hard to remember sometimes that this isn't just the Donald Trump show. There are 10 people at least, and that was just in the main event. There was also the four-person undercard. Mm. But one of these people is going to be the Republican nominee for president. Did any of them last night strike you as a likely contender?
Not really for me. The Republican Party's trying to renew itself in various guises, from extreme right religious ethics to anti-Mexican stance that we saw last night. So, you know, if this is the best that they can actually put in front of us, then I think that Hillary Clinton's in a good spot at the moment.
I suspect she watched it last night with considerable satisfaction. But this is the thing that strikes me as well, and I'll ask you, Phil, whether you think the Republican, whether there's something here that I'm missing, in that it struck me last time out, and in fact the time out before that, that the Republican Party has not learned or will not learn that there are just not enough angry middle-aged white guys in America anymore to get you the White House. And they still don't seem to have figured that out.
There seems to be a real complacency that the anti-Hillary sentiment is going to be strong enough that whatever the Republicans put up will win. But I think you're absolutely right. I don't think that sentiment is there in enough numbers for the Republicans to win on that basis. And the Democrats are playing this very smart. They're basically letting the Republicans make all the noise, make fools of themselves. I'm sure they'll have a much more civilized Democratic debate next week or the week after. Interesting twists and turns could happen there. If Biden, kind of enters the race, or if, if Bernie Sanders, sort of chips away at Hillary's lead more than he has thus far, that could get interesting. But I think Peter's absolutely right. Hillary seems to have an open field at the moment. And if she doesn't make any major blunders between now and next year, she looks a pretty good bet for the presidency.
Peter, did you get the idea that anybody's odds either noticeably shortened or lengthened last night? I mean, it's really hard when there's, I mean, even though it did go on for 3 hours and then some, and did degenerate to this ludicrous bit at the end where they were asked to nominate their own Secret Service code names.
That's right, yeah. And all of the mudslinging and, you know, I'm afraid that you know this Fox News land that makes up a good part of the U.S. and I've spent a lot of time in the U.S. and I could never figure it out, and I've spoken to a lot of Americans about it. But you know that Fox News land kind of mentality that Donald Trump is obviously keying into with these kind of rabid slogans and hate talk that would have got most other people kicked out of the room, but he seems to be able to use it for fuel. So I think it's hard to say because he is the cat among the pigeons, and it's scrambled all of the criteria that we typically use to actually make sense of it all. I just wonder how far he can go, what he has to say before, you know, Joe Sixpack says, hold on, though, that's a step too far. Are there any limits? Are there any moral kind of boundaries in which Trump can actually kind of contravene? It's fascinating stuff.
And final thought on this from you, Phil, just from on last night's performance, did any of the 11 in the main event look more or less like a candidate than before they walked on? I mean, there's some people suggesting that, you know, is Chris Christie possibly, you know, possibly due the, it would be the mother of all comebacks from where he is. But in the absence of relatively plausible contenders,
It's difficult to see anyone in that lot who ticks all of the main sort of mainstream Republican boxes, because you've got candidates that are anti-immigration, which seems to resonate in some part of the population, but in the same breath are kind of pro-gay marriage or pro-abortion. So I think this idea of kind of scrambling the criteria is exactly right. Mm. You don't see in this group of candidates what you have seen in previous Republican showdowns, which is a single candidate who seems to bring all of the kind of key Republican concerns together. And I think that's going to knock most of them out. Mm. But my fear is that if that is the case, someone like Trump, because he gets so much of the bandwidth and makes so much of the noise, is the one that's going to be chosen. Not because he's consistent and convincing on policy grounds, but simply because everyone else is so incoherent, he's the loudest he's going to come through.
Well, we will take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Peter Fleming and Phil Clark. Coming up next, separatists in Ukraine plan an election which won't get them a new government, and Australia gets a new government without an election.
There's so much more to Hong Kong than its sea of skyscrapers. And Monocle's new travel guide is here to help you discover a different and captivating side to this complex and ever-changing city.
This city isn't one that will let go of its past easily. Hong Kong is marked by an eclectic confluence of archaic and futuristic, deliberate and accidental, all of which can make exploring the city a dizzying experience.
From food to retail, art to architecture, Monocle Films takes you on a journey through the city to celebrate the publication of the Monocle Travel Guide to Hong Kong, premiering now in the film section of monocle.com.
And you're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me are Peter Fleming and Phil Clark. Now, in and of itself, there is not a great deal to admire about the Donetsk People's Republic, the region of eastern Ukraine, which has operated as a Kremlin client state since Russia's still unadmitted invasion last year. They do, however, not want for nerve. The secessionists have announced their intention to hold elections on October 18th, a week ahead of official Ukrainian elections a week later. Peter, first of all, are the Donetsk People's Republic just trying to annoy everybody, or are they going somewhere with this?
It's a provocation. Russian-driven provocation as much as anything. And I think we've got to keep in mind also that the Malaysian Flight 17 report is coming out, the end of the investigation is coming out next month, around the same time. So I think that's going to be quite important as well. And this is a way to shore up very, very badly, and of course they're going to fail, but shore up in their mind the legitimacy of this particular geographical region, but you know it's getting messier and messier. I heard the other day that Elton John has a special phone line to Putin, so maybe we could send him in there to sort out this mess as well, because he's at the vanguard of gay and lesbian rights in Russia.
Well, somebody has to be. Phil, is this the beginning of the DPR trying to establish itself as a sort of Transnistria or a South Ossetia, a sort of weird, not recognised but, you know, acknowledged Russian outpost?
It does seem that way. And it's interesting to me what a charade elections have become in so many parts of the world, that this is simply a performance. It doesn't really matter whether that gets us to a democratic outcome. It's all about what this looks and what claims leaders can make off the back of that. And that seems to be what the Donetsk People's Republic is doing at the moment. What's staggering as well is in light of these rebels trying to claim some sort of democratic credentials, Poroshenko, having accused the rebels of being anti-democratic, turned around and placed sanctions on almost all of the rebel leaders and a ton of Ukrainian journalists
and foreign journalists as well.
BBC journalists. Yeah.
So it's interesting what's being done in the name of democracy in Ukraine at the moment.
Peter, you said it was a provocation, which I think is probably a reasonable analysis. Kiev, as well as the EU and the US, say that this would be a breach of the Minsk agreement, which has brought about a ceasefire which is more or less intact, which it would appear to be exactly that. Might that be exactly why they're doing it?
It could very well be. Also, Putin wants to... Putin's been on the back foot on a number of areas with oil prices, discontent in Russia at the moment as well around the economy. So, and he is the master of using various political theatrics, I think, Phil. That's a very, very good analysis regarding the performance part of this whole ordeal, using these theatrics to garner support and to shore up support back in Russia. So it's very, very difficult to see what the outcome of this is going to be, but it's been dragging on for a long time and it doesn't seem to be actually coming to a head. And one wonders whether the EU and the UN really do have the commitment to actually do something about it.
You mentioned there, Phil, the crackdown by Kiev on reporters, including foreign reporters, including the BBC, who've been banned from the country. I have read up and down about this back and forth, and I cannot figure out what Poroshenko thinks works for him here. To which gallery is he attempting to play?
Yeah, it seems fundamentally confused, because it's not clear to me what the domestic audience would be that would be won over by this kind of move. It's guaranteed to annoy almost all of the European and international backers, and Putin must be rubbing his hands with glee, thinking, well, this guy's doing my work for me. And in the last couple of days, the rebels have probably come out of this looking even more democratic, which is quite a staggering outcome. So a drastic own goal by Poroshenko.
Well, finally tonight on this all Antipodean edition of Midori House, two of the people in this studio, along with our producer, are among the few Australian citizens who haven't had a crack at being Prime Minister this decade. The latest through the revolving door is former Communications Minister Malcolm Turnbull, who unhorsed the unpopular Tony Abbott in a party room joust earlier this week to become Australia's fourth leader since 2010. It is getting hilarious. It's like Italy in the 70s at this point. Peter, first of all, actually, as a New Zealand citizen, are you technically allowed to have a pop at being Prime Minister of Australia?
I think I'm not too sure. I lived in Melbourne for 5 or 6 years, and at this rate, I don't see why not.
Once they've gone round the actual passport holders, we might have to start asking your people as well. Do you think it's likely that? I mean, it is extraordinary. This is it three prime ministers in a row now which haven't made to the end of their first term before they've been knifed by their own colleagues? Do you think Turnbull might have a bit more staying power?
He probably does. He probably does. He models himself after John Key. He actually said this the other day. And John Key, ex-investment banker, taking up a political stance that the philosopher Tariq Ali calls the extreme centre. And it's an interesting development because, you know, you don't look right-wing, whereas you really are in economic policy, but you don't look left-wing, which is considered to be dangerous. So he's taken up the extreme centre, which is bland, moderate in a number of areas, whereas the problem with Tony Abbott is that he was pretty weird. And, you know, for example, biting into an onion, you know, if he actually come out and said, look, I had stage fright and, you know, under pressure from the media, you know, I thought it was an apple. But I asked later, he just said, you know, yeah, no, I actually eat onion, raw onions. I like them. Which you know, so he was a strange individual, driven by a weird view of the world. So I think Malcolm Turnbull will be a lot more stable.
I mean, in fairness to Tony Abbott, which believe me is not a phrase I utter lightly, any survey of the biographies of the men and one woman who've been Prime Minister of Australia does reveal a fairly profoundly eccentric bunch in one way or another. Phil, is there a Tony Abbott legacy as such? Have we had, I mean, leaving aside the ones who were barely in the job long enough, the sort of the Faddens and the Fords, have we had a less effectual Prime Minister?
Thankfully, that might be the best that can be said about Abbott, is that he's left almost no trace. And I think someone as potentially dangerous as him was sort of rescued by his own ineptitude. I think that, unfortunately, there is perhaps one thing that he's left, and that is to really bring out even more strongly this kind of xenophobic and racist element in Australia. Mm-hmm. And I don't think it's any accident that we've seen these kind of Islamophobic protests in the last 3 or 4 months, that we've seen just in the Twitter sphere and in social media, just really horrendous bellicose statements made against really anyone with a different skin colour. And I think Abbott has not only permitted that, but riled it in the population. So sadly, I think that's his legacy. I mean, Australian politics in the last 5 years has been unbelievable. I mean, as someone who works on Central Africa, I have to say Central Africa looks extraordinarily stable in comparison. I mean, Congo, Uganda, Rwanda are paragons of stability and democracy compared to what's happened with these five prime ministers, if we count two versions of Rudd.
Rudd had two
years. It's really unbelievable. And I guess the other thing that's really staggering about this is that it's happened in a period of almost unparalleled prosperity in Australia. It's been a boom time. This is one of the few economies that rode out the global financial crisis. Rudd came in with a massive majority in 2007, was praised internationally for his economic management, and yet prime minister after prime minister has been knifed by their own party. And good luck to Turnbull with inheriting that kind of mess.
Well, my own improvised theory about that is that this happens because, for all the reasons you mentioned, because of Australia's prosperity and security, the politicians just get bored. They don't really have anything else to do, so they plot against each other. I mean, Peter, Tony Abbott did give his farewell speech. He's clearly, you know, very sad and very angry, as anybody would be in that circumstance. But he did make what I thought was a pertinent observation, where he made a reference to the extraordinarily febrile nature of modern media, and amplified, I think, by social media, and the fact that does seem to drive an impatience with everything, and an appetite for drama.
It's true that he made so many media gaffes, but unlike, say, someone like George W. Bush, who it seemed to kind of flame his popularity, Tony Abbott come across, as I said before, as just slightly unhinged. And so the media did not work well with regards to his view of the world. Also, I think you've got to keep in mind, given the historical, you know, with so many prime ministers, the Labour Party has for a long time been a really problematic party. It's been factious. It's been so much infighting. Whereas with the Liberal parties after John Howard, are pretty stable. You had to do a lot to really annoy, to come out and be stabbed in the back by your Liberal Party colleagues.
I mean, the Labour Party have a long and proud history of this.
They thrive on it. And there's been various attempts to clean it up and to create proper career paths, and they're all failed because I'm not too sure what exactly it is about the Australian Labour Party. But, you know, it goes to show how far Tony Abbott went to actually be stabbed in the back by his Liberal Party colleagues, because they are generally have a little bit more solidarity in that regard.
Yeah, strangely, it's the opposite to what obtains here in the UK, where it's the Conservative Party that usually have the greater appetite for regicide, and Labour, who will array themselves behind anybody until it becomes obvious. obviously impossible not to. Just finally, Phil, Malcolm Turnbull, does he need to make an effort to distance himself from Tony Abbott, or will the mere fact of not being Tony Abbott do that by itself?
I think so. I think Turnbull could almost ignore Abbott now and never have to mention his name again. And again, the polls have reflected a kind of inherent distrust of Abbott and a fairly, I would say, cautious support for Turnbull. I mean, his popularity ratings have skyrocketed in the last few days. And if he can be seen as a safe pair of hands, if he can be seen as some sort of unifier in a very divided party, and if he can frame himself as a kind of an economic manager, that's going to be music to the electorate's ears. As someone who's voted Labour all my life, I was very glad to see Abbott go, but I actually think Turnbull could be the Labour Party's worst enemy. This guy is profoundly electable and looks on course to win the next election already.
Phil Clark and Peter Fleming, thank you both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's episode of Midori House. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Federico Romaniello. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. For the next half hour, Chris Lord is keeping you company with Monocle's international playlist from Istanbul. At 1900 hours, Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist. At 2200, it's the Monocle Daily with me and Paul Osborne. Midori House returns tomorrow at 1800 London time. But for this edition, it's goodbye and thanks for listening.